say we continue on our own staff side to be impressed and deferential to Fred and his team's skills. When I was contacted by a national organization to see whether Fred could be the kind of their major presenter, I said, absolutely, we need to share his expertise.
Thank you, too, Mr. Ellis. And he'll be speaking about the pandemic flu plan that the Fairfax County Public Schools has. And we had a brief briefing of this, I guess, a couple weeks ago, and actually some closed session review of this, but we thought it was important enough that we could take a little bit more time, and Mr. Ellis would give the public also an opportunity to see the kind of work that goes behind the scenes to ensure that we're prepared for whatever disaster may come our way. Mr. Ellis.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight and share some information, again, that, like you said, we talked a little bit about at the board work session a few weeks ago, and to talk a little bit more this evening, specifically about pandemic flu. Before we begin, I did want to acknowledge and recognize a couple of my staff members that are here. First is Doug O'Neill. Many of you may know is the coordinator of safety and environmental health section. And Gary Ball, our security specialist, who spends a great deal of his time on emergency management issues. As a matter of fact, has spent pretty much full time on pandemic flu over the past almost now 2 years. And Gary is the principal author of our pandemic flu plan and really has done the lion's share of the work. So I appreciate them being here tonight. Before we jump into the pandemic flu piece, I was asked to just speak just real briefly on some of the emergency management components. The way we like to think of the emergency management of FCPS is to break it up into two pieces. One is the school-level plans, which are pretty much the micro-level plans, and there are two components that make up school-level plans. One is the crisis management workbook. This workbook is publicly available on the web. It is our legacy workbook. It was the origin of our current school plans, and it's evolved into a training manual. It covers a lot of basic issues in terms of emergency management, crisis planning, incident command system, and also has specific incident guides for use by school administrators. This document's been shared nationally and internationally, and has been really the kind of backbone of a lot of our work that we've done at the school level. The second piece is the online template, which schools use to develop their plans every year. They're required by law to be updated, and my staff reviews and approves those. They are on an intranet password-protected site. They standardize the format, the topics, the procedures, and terminology schools use, and they also allow for customization for each site. In the plan, they do have a link to their CAD drawings with security-related issues identified on those plans, and these plans are exempt from the Virginia Freedom of Information Act. Switching to the larger view or perspective of emergency management for FCPS is the system-wide emergency operations plan, kind of the macro view. This plan describes how FCPS responds to large-scale events and how we meet our obligations to the county, events that involve multiple schools or events that would overwhelm a single school. And as I said, our obligations to the county emergency operations plan, such things as shelter, provisions, mass feeding, and other issues. With that, I wanted to switch gears and spend some time talking about pandemic flu, because this has been a very big topic in the public health world, and particularly government and private organizations. In order to understand how we got here in terms of the planning, I think it's important to understand some of the background issues. And these background issues really do form the basis of our planning process. A pandemic outbreak is defined as having three specific parts: the emergence of a new influenza A virus that causes serious illness and that is capable of spreading easily worldwide. Currently, as you know, there is no pandemic flu anywhere in the world right now. Those three, we do not have all three of those components. We do have two of them, the first two, do exist in the world. When would a pandemic flu event happen? No one really knows. I think it's been interesting to note that, in my opinion, the media coverage has declined somewhat over the past year or so on this topic. However, I can tell you that it does remain to be a very huge issue in the public health community. As of today, there have been 328 cases, and 200 of those have been fatalities since 2003 worldwide for the H5N1 avian flu virus. What would an influenza pandemic look like in our country and our community? We should expect no help from other jurisdictions, as it really would impact the entire country. You could expect it to spread very quickly, coming in multiple waves, lasting 2 to 3 months at a time, as it gets reintroduced into the community. And there may be very little warning, depending on the efficacy of the surveillance systems in place by the WHO and CDC. It can be easily spread even before the onset of illness. And, of course, we all know kids are very, very effective transmitters of viruses and illnesses. What we call in the public health one, the R-naught factor, which is basically how many individuals you can expect an infected person to in turn infect, would be about 2, according to the public health world, so that every person would then infect, you know, as many as 2 other individuals. So you can get a doubling of the infection rate every 2 to 3 days, and it'd be virtually no immunity in the community. It can be spread by those that don't appear to be or feel ill. The disease attack rate, referred to as the morbidity rate, could be as high as 30% to 40%. And about 50% of those that become ill are expected to seek medical attention. This would, of course, have a huge impact on the healthcare system as requirements for healthcare service skyrocket and risks that healthcare workers face themselves. Antiviral drugs will not be readily available, widely available. However, they believe the supply that they do have may be somewhat effective in reducing the titer rates, thereby reducing the severity of the illness. The best tool against a flu virus is a vaccine. Unfortunately, a vaccine would take at least 6 months to produce a limited quantity, at least initially. So we cannot count on vaccine being available. We should expect absenteeism rates could go as high as 40% during the peak time due to illness and caring for the ill. And the secondary effects would take place in terms of the community mitigation efforts that we're going to talk about. Those secondary effects would increase the absenteeism rate as the illness continues in the community. You could expect an impact on the entire community and the economy. Of course, transportation, commerce, utilities, public safety, all would be challenged to continue their service provisions. A 1918 pandemic today would truly be a horrible event. The data on the slide there predicts about, again, this is a severe pandemic, and the data is for the U.S. only, but would project almost 2 million deaths. And this is without community intervention efforts, and this is, again, kind of like the 1918 severe pandemic. To kind of extrapolate that data and give you a picture of what it would look like in Fairfax County, the data from the county's health department plan for pandemic flu would predict, again, in a severe pandemic and during an 8-week wave with about a 30% morbidity rate, which could be a little higher. Anyways, that would get you about 300,000 ill in Fairfax County, with about 3,000 hospitalized and approximately 700 fatalities. It's interesting to look at some of the data historically. This is a graph looking at some of the data from the 1918 pandemic. The experience in two cities, and what a difference they had in terms of the excess mortality rate. And of course, the public health world has asked why. Why are these so significantly different? The answers, they believe, are the fact that, for instance, St. Louis and the two cities were Philadelphia and St. Louis, used early and sustained community mitigation interventions where the mayor closed theaters, schools, shows, all large gatherings in the community, whereas Philadelphia waited too long. They went ahead with a scheduled parade that had huge crowds, high-density kind of events, which facilitated the spread of the virus. And in this one, you can see that when the mayor of St. Louis withdrew the closing order, the number of cases began to rise slightly. In February 2007, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, published their interim guidance for pandemic planning. Our office was able to participate in several panel discussions with the CDC in Atlanta that contributed to the development of the publication, specifically the appendix regarding schools. We also participated with the U.S. Department of Ed, providing them feedback on their guidance, on their interim guidance. One of the key things that came out of the CDC's publication, which we thought was really a good piece of work, is the development of the severity categories, and it's based on excess mortality specific to a pandemic. So you can see from the slide history, the 1918 pandemic would have been a Category 5. If you think about comparing it to a hurricane scale, so 1918 was truly a bad event with an excess mortality rate of higher than 2.0. The CDC also provided guidance for interventions by the type of the environment and based on the severity of the pandemic. For school closures, they recommend for a severe pandemic, an index of 4 or 5, school closures for up to 12 weeks. Obviously, a less severe pandemic, they would recommend through the health departments a closures of a shorter duration. They also recommend social distancing actions, again, depending on the severity of the event, use of teleconferencing, telecommuting, canceling large events, social distancing actions would also be recommended based on the severity. These community mitigation interventions are called, referred to as NPIs or non-pharmaceutical interventions, and they basically, there's a summary of them, basically asking sick folks to stay home, treating them with antiviral medication, asking household members of sick folks to stay home too, closing schools, and social distancing at work. And the important piece with these non-pharmaceutical interventions is the importance of instituting them early and uniformly across the community. Because once a pandemic begins, our strategies are designed to hopefully slow the arrival and the peak of the pandemic in the community, thereby buying additional time to put preparatory and protective measures into place, reducing the peak of the illnesses and deaths, thereby limiting the pressure on the healthcare system and other sectors at any given specific time, and of course reduce the overall numbers of illnesses and deaths as represented by the area under the curve. You're basically squishing down that graph and trying to buy time for vaccine production. Social density, as I've indicated, really is a key factor in transmissibility of influenza. This graph shows why school environments are environments unlike most others, whereas elementary schools have a density of about 3.9 feet, and hospitals a little bit bigger, offices almost 12 feet, and residences about 16 feet. Some people say that, you know, if we close schools, we're sending the kids at home, and they'll just congregate at home, and the efficacy of your intervention measures won't be fulfilled. However, if you extrapolate the density figures for a school setting to a home setting, you get a picture that looks something like this. This is what you'd have to do in terms of number of kids in a household to reach those density levels that we find in a school environment. The secondary effects on the individuals and communities are also wide-ranging, particularly in the absence of these community-wide interventions. Workplace absenteeism related to school closure, child minding, also obviously the absenteeism related to quarantine and illness impacts families and communities. One of the issues of using these intervention measures is the sustainability of them. People get pretty tired of being stuck at home. And we all know that, having been stuck home with my kids on a few snow days. So that's the background and a lot of the assumptions that drove our planning process. Our plan is made up of several components. You have them there before you on the slide, and we're going to walk through those fairly quickly. The base plan has its purpose and objectives, basically. It includes implementation of our plan within 2 hours of notification, with the intention of sustaining essential functions, supporting of the non-pharmaceutical interventions by public health order. The essential functions were defined as only those lines of business that must continue with no or minimal disruption. There will be some functions suspended. The planning scenarios for school systems, we had to plan on basically the schools being open for some period of time, again, on a less severe pandemic event, and then, of course, closed. We still have functions that must take place even when schools are closed, so we had to consider those. Our planning assumptions obviously included the implications of the non-pharmaceutical intervention. What does that mean for us? And that obviously forms the basis of a lot of our planning. We had to take into account the different implementation and response actions that are outlined and spoken to in many of the guidance documents, different responsibilities for the department, and then, of course, the planned maintenance becomes very much an important component. We also included an action matrix. We recognize that the various terms can be very confusing. So this matrix is our attempt to pull them together. For instance, the WHO uses phases, the term phases. The U.S. federal government uses stages. We have to incorporate the severity index, and we have to incorporate the FCPS response steps into all these different components. And then we look at it from terms of where are we in this event in terms of communications, campus access, educational delivery modes, extracurricular activities, gatherings, meetings, personnel, transportation, plan operations, and FCPS response steps, just to name a few. But we wanted to capture those main issues in the columns, basically, in this matrix. The department appendices are a big part of the plan. We asked each of the assistant superintendents to carefully review those and identified their lines of succession for each of their office. We asked them to identify both their essential and non-essential functions and their non-essential staff, as well as their essential staff, for redistribution of resources and event, and also computing minimum staffing and identifying key folks. So we know, for instance, what the minimum staffing level is, the tipping point, if you will, for transportation. How many drivers do they actually need at any given point to fulfill their mission? And we relied a great deal on the departments for their content. We did ask some departments some specific issues, and we included to them the Department of Education's draft guidance on federal implications. And we shared these with Instructional Services, Department of Special Services, and Department of Accountability. And anyways, we asked them some key questions that we thought were critical. We also addressed those to HR, our human resources. Obviously, a lot of implications for those kinds of decisions, and IT, Division Council, and of course, OCR, our Office of Community Relations for their communications piece. We also developed and wrote an improvement plan to capture the main issues that remain to be resolved. We identified which departments we thought those responsibilities were at. We looked at coordination and codependencies, and also applied some status and due dates, and it's our intention to move forward with that. Excuse me. And once those main issues are addressed, we'll continue on, as there are, I'm sure, others that we will have come across. We also included a piece on personal protection equipment that becomes very much a concern for employees during such an event, and Doug O'Neill was the lead on that, basically incorporating information from the CDC and OSHA, looking at potential impact on FCPS employees, whether or not we need to stockpile some PPE, personal protection equipment, what that means in terms of fit testing and funding. So that, in a nutshell, is what went into the planning process. I know you've been provided copies of the documents, and I apologize for their length. You can blame Gary Ball for that. It has been quite a task, and it is not done, and I don't ever expect it to be finished. It will, in fact, be a living document. We recognize that. It's our intent after this briefing to move very quickly and work with Office of Community Relations to put much of this information on the public website, as the public obviously remains very interested, and understandably so.
Thank you, Mr. Olive. Appreciate it. It was obviously very thorough, and I'm hoping that people in the public, if they take nothing else from the presentation, they'll take how seriously we view these issues and how really comprehensive your responses have been to looking at all the different possible scenarios and making sure we've anticipated as many as possible. So,
thank you.
Mr. Delsiechner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have two or three quick questions. You'd mentioned, Mr. Ellis, that from your perspective, the media has kind of lost touch with this a bit. I don't quite remember the words you used, but it's not as high a profile an issue, but yet the health community remains very concerned about it. How about Fairfax County? How are we as a county?
I think that's a great question, and it is my personal opinion that it has kind of fallen off the radar scope with the media, and I hope not in the community, but that is my sense. In terms of Fairfax County, I really should have included them at the beginning in terms of the acknowledgments. The health department has been a terrific collaborative partner with us all along. They came out with their pandemic flu plan late last summer, I think it was, and I know they are writing revisions to that to incorporate many of the issues from the CDC guidelines. It remains a very big issue, not just in the health department of Fairfax County, but also in the county government. All the agencies are doing what we're doing in terms of pandemic flu planning, so it is very much a very high priority.
As I understand it, we don't really make the call about whether to keep the schools open or for how long. Is that correct?
Well, our division council's read on the authority to close school rests with the state health commissioner and, of course, with the board and the superintendent for absenteeism or other issues that they feel are in the best interest of the school system. The ultimate authority is still a little bit up in question. The county's plan reflects that the local health director has the authority to order. Our division council is not quite so sure. So that is one of the issues on our improvement plan in terms of clarifying exactly, making sure we're all on the same page in terms of who has what authority. I think from a practical perspective, it's less important because we work so collaboratively with the county. I can't envision a scenario possible where they would recommend X and we would say we're going to do Y or vice versa. So we are all on the same page, but I think it's important that we ultimately clarify that legal issue.
Something that would just all of a sudden happen, that the decision needs to be made quickly, or is it something that, for example, the board would have a heads up that this is a something that could be possible. Next 2 weeks, a decision will be made, or would we wake up one morning and say and hear that the health director has decided that the situation is critical?
Yeah, my sense is that we would have a fairly good inkling of it. The WHO has spent a lot of time and money and resources in doing surveillance around the world. Different countries have participated with different levels of vigor, if you will, in that effort. So, to answer your question, my sense is that we would have some prior warning, some information about it. However, we have to recognize that it also, the virus, the piece, again, the important piece is the virus is there. All the first two pieces are there. This virus just needs to modify itself into a type that is easily transmissible between humans. That's the only piece that's missing. And I guess my point in that could occur here. It could occur overseas. I think it's likely to occur over in Indonesia, you know, in those kinds of areas. But, you know, no one really can predict, but I'm hopeful that we would have at least some warning.
Last question on the question of mitigation. If we are, in fact, it's necessary to close schools for some period of time, what's the mitigation of the educational process? Do we have any plans that are part of your mix that would address students being able to continue to do some type of learning activity while they're off?
It is a critical piece of the plan in terms of continuity of education. You know, what level, what kind of, is it going to be an exposure, educational exposure, or something a little more more meat on it? ISD is working on that as we speak. We've spoken with them last week about that, and they are working on it. It is yet to be defined, but they understand that that is a critical piece and an expectation that they come up with something. Not there yet.
Thank you, Mr. Jelsiak. Ms. Strauss?
I just wanted to thank you all for the amount of planning and responsibility that you all have taken on our behalf as not only a large employer in the county, but obviously a place where tens of thousands of human beings gather, and in the kind of a health situation, as you'd indicated in your slide, the fact that there's so many folks coming together, that means we have a tremendous responsibility to help mitigate whatever situation comes forward. And I know also in your planning for safety and security and all the other areas, what an outstanding job you all have done. And the work that you have done has been used as a model, I believe, in hearings with Congress. So we are very grateful. And one of the reasons why you're here tonight is you were going to present this at a work session, and we decided that this really needed to be done in a public session so that the community could see as well. Because a lot of our parents ask, how safe are our children? And we reassure them that our first responsibility is to make sure that the children are safe. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strauss. Mr. Jelsiak, can you go back?
We recently got some inquiries based on away from pandemic into emergency protection or security. CNN had a report on schools being part of a potential target, and that there's data available by nefarious people or with nefarious people who might be targeting schools. You expressed to us at a work session you were well aware of this, but is there anything that any additional insight that you can share with us, with the community, about that situation and whether there's a reason that we need to be particularly concerned?
I've had extensive conversations with contacts in the U.S. Department of Education Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools and through other intelligence connections through the police department and the Joint Terrorism Task Force. I can tell you that they are not aware of any credible information at this time that would lead them to believe that such an attack is imminent.
Thank you, Mr. Ella. Thank you very much. I think we We have learned a great deal, not only tonight, but previously at our work session about how prepared the school system is, and I think we should all be confident that we've done as much as humanly possible to be prepared. And I know the people of Fairfax County thank you, and I know this board deeply appreciates your work and the work of your staff and making sure that we're ready for what we hope never occurs. Thank you again. The next order of business is action items, and I call on Ms. Corey for a motion.
Thank you. My computer is not pulling the motion up, so, okay. I move that the school board appoint individuals to serve on the Family Life Education Curriculum Advisory Committee as listed in the agenda item.
Thank you, Ms. Corey. Is there a second to that motion? Mr. Jesse Eichner? We have a motion and a second to appoint individuals to serve on the Family Life Education Curriculum Advisory Committee. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion, signify by raising your hand, please. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. I call on